From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Mike Pesca.
The pinnacle of the sport, 2,500 dogs began here. We're down to seven.
The winner of the working group, Giant Schnauzer, number seven. The winner of the toy group, Brussels Griffon, number 10.
Thank you all. I love them all. Tonight, the Sussex.
The Sussex Spaniels!
Yes, the Sussex. Stump. He takes it all. And those breeds were some of the ones who made the finals at this year's Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. And for the rest of the hour, we'll be talking about man's best friend of all breeds, how we've shaped their evolution through the years, and the relationship we have today. The guests right now are Stanley Coren, author of The Modern Dog, A Joyful Exploration of How We Live with Dogs Today. He's also a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. He joins us from the studios of the CBC in Vancouver. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Coren.
Glad to be here.
And Matthew Breen is a professor of genomics at the College of Veterinary Medicine at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. He's a member of the Center for Comparative Medicine and Translational Research there. He joins us on the phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Breen.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be with you.
And I want to start off by talking about the book, Dr. Coren, because the first chapter grabbed me. It was basically laid out how the history of dogs tracks with the history of guns. Could you explain why that is?
Well, it's actually with the history of technology. Mm-hmm. And I just chose guns as sort of the example of it. You have to understand that dogs are an invented species. And so early on, we've been doing sort of seat-of-the-pants genetics to shape dogs to what we want. And early on, before there were decent firearms, we had hounds, and the hound's job was to find the game, track it, and pull it down. And the hunter's job was just to get there in time before the dog ate all the food, or if it was a large animal, to make the final kill.
Right. So the hounds would do the hunting for the hunter.
That's right, totally independently. And the next stage up was when we had muzzle-loading weapons. Now, there it takes you about, 20, 30 seconds to load, and then you get only about, 25, 50 yards worth of decent shot range. So what you needed was you needed a dog which would be able to find the game and allow the hunter to get very, very close. And so then we had the pointer, and the pointer is very slow moving and moves along, and when he finds the game, he freezes on in that position, sometimes with that classic paw up, staring at the location where he thinks the game is, so the hunter can sneak up and get very, very close, and then he uses the dog to flush the game, and he's close enough so that he actually stands a chance to knock it down.
And the slowness of the dog is fine because you have a slow weapon as well.
That's right. And once you started to get sort of breech-loading weapons, which were much faster, you could work behind setters. And setters move much more quickly. And it's best to work setters in pairs because what happens is, like a pointer, they'll freeze. But if you have two different setters and they both frozen in place, then you can locate the exact bush behind which the game is by just sort of triangulating. And the setters let you know how close they think they are to the game by the beat of their tail. And then we began to get really good, shotguns. For that, you could then hunt behind spaniels. I mean, hunting behind spaniels is incredibly exciting, but they're totally undisciplined hunters. They sort of quarter the ground in front of you, and they flush whatever it is which is in front of them. So it's exciting, but if you didn't have the decent shotgun, things would go very badly.
Right.
Anyway, then the Industrial Revolution hits, and all of the good hunting land starts to go away, and Basically, hunters are stuck using scrap land like marshes and that kind of a thing. And that's where you need the retriever. And the retriever has to be a dog which is perfectly willing to sort of, you know, sit very quietly and wait for you to tell it to do something. And you're in a blind and you wait until the ducks come flapping by. Anyway, very recently, that's within the past century, hunters got a little bit tired of that sort of thing. They tried, you know, luring the ducks over to where they were, and they tried using decoys and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So they then invented a dog which is called the Nova Scotia Duck Tolling Retriever.
And do you have one of those?
I have one of those, yes. They're a little red and white dog, very active. They're the most active of the most noisy of the retrievers, at least. And their job is just to go crazy along the edge of the marsh or the lake or whatever else it is. And they twirl around and make yipping sounds. And the ducks, come flying over and they say, "What's going on over there?" And they fly into within the hunter's range. And the hunter gets a chance to sort of knock them down. And then the dog turns into a proper retriever and
right.
should be able to go out.
So this is what I wanted to duck. So this is what I wanted to ask Professor Breed. And there Dr. Corin lays out, over hundreds of years, technology changes, dogs adapt to humans. He could have told that story, I'm sure, with agriculture or any other number of pursuits. It seems natural, and we have all these breeds that we know and love today. But what's going on recently that, in your opinion, sort of warped that whole process of the natural evolution, or at least the guided evolution of breeds of dogs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing to consider is we need to be aware that the history of the relationship between humans and dogs goes back 10, 15,000 years and beyond. And it's very important to realize that over the ensuing 14,500 years, humans and dogs coexisted in very much a symbiotic relationship. And then, as Dr. Corin says, what happens is during that time, we breed dogs because they provide us with a specific function. Generally, we're breeding them because they serve as a purpose to help mankind survive. But then certainly around Industrial Revolution times, the attitude towards dog breeding tended to change, and we started to move away from dogs that served a day-to-day purpose more to dogs that we selected for a particular way in which they appear. Mm-hmm. We started to breed dogs what we would refer to as desirable physical characteristics, and this might mean a particular size, a particular shape of the head, a particular coat color, a particular coat texture. But what happened in a very rapid period over 200 or 300 years is we went from relatively few breeds of dog to maybe 200, 300, 400 breeds of dog that now are so vastly different in morphology that the domestic dog as a species probably represents the one species that has the greatest morphological variation of all mammals. As a consequence of that, what's happened in terms of selecting animals to look like the next generation is breeders tend to choose individuals that look very similar. And one of the ways to do that is to breed animals that are more closely related.
Inbreeding.
It's a kind of inbreeding and line breeding. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing that we do for milk production in cattle. It's the same thing we do to reduce the size of wheat in the fields. It's a way to generate individuals that have desirable characteristics. One of the problems of that we now know is that in so doing, by selecting for the way that a dog looks, i.e. it's what we call its phenotype, we're actually selecting for a particular set of genes. And by concentrating those genes over a relatively short period of time from a relatively limited gene pool, we run the risk, as has happened in many breeds, of increasing the presence of genetic disorders. So we're here in the 21st century with a number of dog breeds that have a very, very high incidence of genetic diseases, including cancers.
And Professor Corin, what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, that sort of thing has been happening. There is always a bit of a tension between the people and the dog fancy. That's the people who breed dogs to be beautiful. So these are the dogs which you see being shown in Westminster and that sort of thing. And the people who breed the dogs for field or function, in which case they're basically breeding the dogs for what the dog will do, for its behaviors and that kind of a thing. Now, you know, it's a mixed bag as to what's going on nowadays because for example, Irish setters used to have a major problem with a weak heart septum. and the Irish Setter Club in the States decided that they wanted to see whether they could eliminate that from the breed. And so they put in about $250,000 to the Canine Genome Project over several years. That's the same project which Dr. Breen has been associated with in part. And they actually were able to find a genetic marker which could be detected in a simple blood test. And basically, over the past few years, they've been cleaning up the breed. So the breed is getting stronger and because we have the technology to do it. And because of the fact that the breeders, for the most part, really care about those dogs. I mean, you know, yes, they want beautiful dogs, but they also want healthy dogs because they happen to love that particular breed.
And let me give out our number. It's 1-800-989-TALK, or you could tweet us with at Cy Fry on Twitter. If you have a dog, if you are a dog, we'll accept your tweet also. I want to get to communication because dogs, the theory is that wolves are a much tougher animal. Wolves can do a lot more damage. They might be better at hunting down prey. And yet, why is it that dogs are so much more evolutionarily successful? Theory is they're just good at interacting and reading the emotions of the human being. What do you think of that, Stanley Coren?
Well, actually, dogs are much more successful, especially in association with people, because the ecology, the sort of the place where dogs belong in terms of our world environment is with people. I mean, they fit our lifestyle, and therefore they've prospered. And in fact, you know, there are 56 million dogs in the U.S., and there are only about 700,000 wolves in the entire world. So if, you know, in Darwinian terms, dogs are a lot more successful. But we've bred them for very, very specific kinds of behaviors. There's a wonderful set of research which has looked at how dogs read human beings and read their communication and their gestures and that sort of thing. For example, a character by the name of Brian Hare from Harvard did some wonderful studies which show that if you point to something, a dog recognizes that that's a communication gesture, and he looks in the direction that you're pointing, whereas a wolf, if you point to something, looks at your hand. Now, that wolf will look at your hand even if he has been reared with humans from a puppy, whereas a domestic dog will look in the direction you're going from about the age of 8 or 9 weeks. So that means to say we've actually bred dogs to interpret certain communication gestures. Now, there's a whole set of dogs, the ones which we call companion dogs. Some people call them little frou-frou dogs and that sort of thing. But those little dogs have been bred very specifically to read human emotions. And so they're very empathic. And so, you know, you get excited and happy and the dog gets excited and happy. You come in and feel, you know, mumphy and the dog snuggles up next to you on the sofa. Again, we sort of breeding dogs to pick up on those particular cues. And that's why they fit. That's why they work so well. You know, dogs are man's best friend because dogs may be man's best invention.
I'm Mike Pesca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And it works the other way, doesn't it? Because your book has a lot of information about not only how dogs can read humans, but small children who grow up with dogs wind up can read the dogs, can learn empathy from the dogs. And I think you have a lot of studies that suggest that children who grow up with dogs not only are physically healthier, they're better at reading other people as well. Perhaps they learn that from the dogs.
Yeah. Kids and dogs work together very, very well, especially certain breeds of dogs. And there's a lot of research which shows that if we look at the social maturity of a child, if he's grown up in a household with a dog, he actually is more socially mature. He has more empathy. And by empathy here, we simply mean that you read an emotion in somebody else and you respond appropriately. It's almost as though the child is interacting with the dog and is learning to read the dog, to pay attention to bodily cues and that sort of thing, and then transfers that to human beings. And kids, you know, the relationship which kids have with dogs is quite remarkable. I mean, you a number of studies look at kids' relationships, and they find that children say that they can tell their dog things which they would never tell to their parents or their siblings.
Things like, I drank from the toilet. No,
sorry. Hopefully not.
You would understand.
It's also the case that if you ask kids to list the most important members of their family, the kids will very often list the family dog over, you know, their brothers and sisters as being sort of more important and a better friend. And one of the things which becomes quite clear is that the kids who work with dogs well, I mean, who have dogs at home, also seem to be able to work with other kids well. They seem to fit in, and so they're transferring those skills. So dogs are sort of a non-threatening way that kids can get a whole lot of social experience.
And not only in this soft way, let's say non-hard science, we are actually looking at dogs to learn about human cancers, and I think some of your research, Matthew Breen, has led us to this point, yes?
Yeah, this is true. One of the main striking features that we found when the canine genome was sequenced, which was a real revolutionary event in canine genetics, is that we started to have the tools and the abilities, as is currently available for human science, to start really delving into cells of dogs and saying, why do so many dogs get so much cancer? And one of the things that we found pretty early on is that very many cancers in people are recurrently associated with specific genetic changes. And what's striking when you look at dog cancers and human cancers is they're remarkably similar in their clinical and physiological presentation. So it kind of makes sense that we now know that the canine genome is very, very similar to the human genome. We know that our dogs, as Stanley Curran's just highlighted, live with us. They are our pets. They breathe the same air. They drink the same water. We know that the genome of a dog, the DNA of a dog, is exposed to exactly the same environment as is our own DNA, that if we get cancers, be there or be there not an environmental influence, there's a chance that dogs will get cancers of a similar type. And this is what veterinary oncologists see all the time. What's even more striking is that when we go looking at particular dog cancers for genetic changes, if we wind back the evolutionary clock, what we find is that the same genetic changes that cause and are associated with cancers in people are also caused and associated with cancers in dogs.
And we're going to leave it there for a second, but we will be right back after a short break, and we'll be talking about something that we've dubbed the doggy cell phone. So hang on for a minute, if you will. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, and I'm Mike Pesca. We're talking this hour about dogs, how we've shaped them, how we communicate with them, and how they communicate with us. Our guests are Stanley Curran, the author of The Modern Dog, A Joyful Explanation of How We Live with Dogs Today, Matthew Breen, professor of genomics at the College of Veterinary Medicine at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. And I'd like to bring in another guest right now. He's working on technology that will let your dog bark on the cell phone to you in times of distress. Let me introduce him now. Eyal Zahavi is the founder and CEO of Biosense Technologies in Tel Aviv, Israel. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hi, Mike. This is Eyal.
Hello, Eyal.
Very, very happy to be with you guys and the listeners.
So what is this thing you're working on? My dog's going to start calling me and saying something other than more food, more food?
Okay. Yeah, it's very interesting, Mike. Well, many dog owners will tell you that they can tell the difference between an ordinary dog bark and the way the dog barks when alarmed.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of scientific research that proves that alarm bark has different characteristics in terms of pitch and length. Actually, dogs express much more than just alarm or being threatened. We started our efforts on cases where dogs sense something threatens themselves, the territory, or their owner.
And so where is the technology and what's the research taking you to?
Okay, so actually we found out that there are different types of barks for different dogs, and there are universal barks for dogs in threat situations where they feel threatened. Let me tell you a true story. Several years ago, there was a prison break here in Israel,
mm-hmm.
and when they saw the surveillance video, they could see that the dogs were barking nonstop. but the guards never left the post to look outside. That is because either the barks didn't didn't hear the dogs bark, or they learned to ignore them or couldn't tell the difference between an ordinary bark and a threat bark. Our technology can recognize and identify this threat bark because it is universal for all dogs. I mean, we know that distress sounds for human, for birds, for all animals, and also for dogs. And today our systems are installed in most prisons in Israel and homeland security sites. And when the dogs bark this alarm bark, the system picks up and the general alarm goes off.
So how does it? What's the cell phone application? Rather than just alert a prison, a specific owner can have it call his dog call him when there is an alarm to be sounded?
Right. This is very exciting for us. Well, our new product, we call it TeleDog. It's actually a cellular caller, as you said. Mm-hmm. It takes the technology and applies it to the U.S. Dog owner market. Well, we know that there are over 70 million dogs in the U.S., and people see them as a family member. Our vision is to help dogs and their owners communicate. And this is done by using our dog bark translation technology and additional location and movement sensors. TeleDog will notify the owner the minute his dog is alarm barking in response to a threat like, let's say, an intruder, fire, or wild animal.
So I'll be on the phone. I'll be talking to someone and say, hold on, I've got Wolf waiting. I go to the other line. Will I hear my dog barking? Will I hear a recording saying there's something wrong with my dog? What will I hear as the end user, the human part of this chain?
Well, you will actually hear your dog barking. You will hear the surrounding of the dog. It's your home. You hear if the alarm goes off. You hear if the kids are playing. You hear a car goes by. And you actually get a phone call from your dog, and you hear everything going on. I mean, I've been using the caller on my dog, and actually what happens is you hear your dog is talking to you, actually sending you a message. And also embedded in the caller are GPS technology and movement sensor.
Well, how often does your dog call you?
Well, it doesn't happen a lot. I mean, it has to be a real threat. It has to be real alarm box, and it doesn't happen instantly. So the caller has to be sure that these are real alarm box. It doesn't happen if there's a cat or anything, only if there's real threat or danger for the dog or for the home. This is part of our vision to bring peace of mind to the dog owner. He cares about the well-being of the dog. He's part of the family, so he wants to know if there's any threat to the dog, to the premises. He wants to know if the dog gets lost. I mean, GPS, the minute the dog goes away or leave a predefined area, you get a message. The movement sensors monitor the dog 24 hours a day. So if there's anything wrong with the dog, if the dog is ill or something changes with his movement pattern, you will get notified.
And
this information is also available on the website, so you can actually log into the website, see everything that happened with your dog, where he is on the map, his daily movement profile, his number of calories burned. I mean, it's very cool.
Number of calories burned. All right, well, I want to thank you, Eyal Zahavi, for joining us, founder and CEO of BioSense Technologies in Tel Aviv. Thank you.
Just one word.
Yep.
We plan to pilot a product in a few months in the United States, and we will be very happy if people want to be part of the pilot and, you know, just send us emails through our website, www.biosense.com. Go ahead, send us email, be a part of the pilot. We'll be very happy.
All right. Thanks very much. I'm sure a lot
Thank
of people
you,
will be involved. And Stanley, I think I read about in your book, you talked about the possibilities of this. Look, obviously, some part of this technology is that people are so wrapped up in their dogs, they'll buy anything. It's not that hard to take advantage of the anxious dog owner who's out at work worrying and wondering about his dog. But how much science is behind this?
Well, there have been a number of attempts to have doggy decoders and things which interpret the barks. And the reason you can get away with this sort of thing is because there are a couple of dimensions which actually predict what the dog is thinking, if you will. So the first is pitch. So the lower the pitch, the more threatening things are, and the higher pitch, the more submissive or frightened the dog is. And you would hear that in people. If somebody says, "Oh, what's going on?" I mean, you can immediately tell that, in fact, they're worried about something. The next thing is the duration, so how long things are. Generally speaking, longer durations means something that is more thought out. So a dog which is going, is much more likely to attack you than one who goes,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and you get that kind of thing. The next thing is frequency, just how often you repeat these messages, and then also the overall volume. So you can take those four dimensions, and you can program them in to get sort of a general idea as to what the dog's overall emotional state is. Now, you have to be very careful because, you know, there are certain patterns of barks which are also significant. So, for example, you know, people are always complaining, you know, how do I get my dog to stop barking? And when you check, in fact, the dog is giving a series of barks, which are two or three barks with a space in between. So it goes something like, ruff, 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 ruff. And that's really the call the pack bark. It's, mm-hmm. you know, come over here and check this out. And unfortunately, what people tend to do is they shout at their dog, shut up, stop that noise, be quiet, which sounds to the dog like ruff, 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 ruff. Ruff, ruff.
So, in other words, the actual words you use to shut your dog up shouldn't be those short two-syllable words?
That's right, because then the dog thinks to himself, well, you know, I started to call leader of the pack over to check this out. Now, leader of the pack is calling for additional help. You know, I must be doing the right thing.
Right.
So instead of being quiet, the dog, you know, starts to bark ballistically.
So what you might want to say is, Snuggles, I suggest you reconsider your incessant barking as it is driving me crazy.
Well, you don't have to do quite that, okay? The dog wants you to check it out. So if he's barking at a door or a window, you go over to the door or the window, you peek out, and then you turn to the dog and you say, Lassie, nice barking, or nice guarding, whatever, and you go back and sit down at your sofa and call the dog over. And what you'll find, and most people are surprised about this, is that the dog will then come over and settle down very nicely because this was communication. So the dog said, check this out. Leader of the pack, check this out. There's not a problem. Wow, I am the guardian of this domain, okay, and the dog's perfectly happy.
Well, so far we've been talking about human-dog interaction and communication. There is another species that famously just can't quite talk to the dogs. They are, of course, cats. So famous is their animosity that it was immortalized in the movie Ghostbusters.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Now, I always chalk this up to they just don't like each other. But Stanley Coren, you have parts of your book where you actually explain why dogs are from Venus and cats are from Mars or something like that.
Yeah, part of it has to do with the fact that dogs and cats use exactly the same body signals. But in fact, they very often mean something quite different. So, for example, a cat who is being friendly carries his tail sort of almost vertically. For a dog, that's a sign of dominance and being pushy. So, you know, a dog comes, you know, approaches a cat, and the cat wants to be friendly, and a dog reads that tail and says, you know, why are you pushing around over here? In addition, a cat who is hunting tends to hold his tail considerably lower. Now, for a dog, a low tail is submissive. And so if the dog comes over to the cat who looks submissive to him because he's got his tail low, and he gets a face full of fangs and claws, well, he's never going to trust another cat again. And the same sort of thing with ears. I mean, you know, if dogs tend to slick their ears down when they're frightened or submissive or that sort of thing, whereas cats, when they're very angry, the ears start to go sort of down horizontally. It's what I tell my grandkids are airplane wing ears.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that a dog reads the signals, or a cat reads the signals for the dog, and they get into a conflict because the signals are exactly opposite, and after that they never trust anybody else in the species. Now, it turns out that if a dog lives with a cat, for example, the dog will learn to read those signals from the cat.
Just like they learn to read human signals.
That's right.
And
the same thing as living with somebody who has a very heavy foreign accent or that sort of thing. And so the dog will begin to adapt his responses to the signals of that cat. But he'll still treat other cats as though they're giving doggy signals.
Oh, so it's so maybe it's not. Yeah, it's maybe not that he's learned to read cat. He just figures, oh, why fight with this guy? He's going to be with me all my life.
Well, it's he sort of learns to read his cat because, you know, this is the one I live with and he's a bit strange, but, you know, we'll put up with him.
Right. He says to the other dogs, step back. I can read cat. I'm Mike Pesca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, Professor Breen, as you hear all this talk about how dogs and cats don't communicate, you think there's a genetic component? They were just meant not to like each other from the get-go?
I think one of the significant features that we can bring from this is that we know there's a unique bond between humans and dogs. We know there are bonds between humans and cats on an emotional level. But I think listening to this, one of the things I would like to say is that it's not just the vocal cords that bark. It's actually the genome of dogs that also barks. And when I say that, what I refer to is the fact that there's so much genetic information that's been hidden away and locked away inside the canine genome that we're now starting to pull out that's providing us with information, warning signs, if you like, about our own health.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that's very intriguing, as we alluded to earlier, is that we're starting to find, as a consequence of the limited level of genetic variability in certain dog breeds, it's actually a lot easier for us to find the genes that go wrong in pure dog breeds than it is in human populations. We spend billions of dollars a year trying to reduce the incidence of cancer and to treat humans with cancers. What we're starting to find is that by looking at dogs as what we would call a biological or a biomedical model for cancer, we're starting to find information that not only helps us develop new therapies for dogs, but at the same time, selfish as we humans are, it's also allowing us to develop new therapies for humans. And this is one of the reasons why, certainly where I work now in North Carolina, we're so privileged to be working in an area where there are two of the nation's best academic medical schools, be it Duke and UNC, and one of the nation's leading vet schools here at NC State, where what's happening is when we find the information in the dog patients here, what we do is take that genetic information and hand those data over to our colleagues at the medical schools, and what they then start to do is look within their own patient populations to see whether they can tease out information that probably is not that evident when they first start to look at human populations.
And so when we find some genetic diseases that afflict dogs, would the advice be, well, don't breed those dogs that have them? Or is there some other better, smarter way to deal with dogs with diseases?
In many cases, it depends on the nature and the genetic basis of the disease. But in most cases, most geneticists would say that's absolutely not the right thing to do. There are 20,000 genes or so that make up a dog. It may be it's just one gene that's gone rogue in that dog, but the other 19,999 genes that make up that dog could be offering highly beneficial traits and genetic features to that population of dogs.
All right, go ahead, finish your thought.
So my point was that it's not a question of removing dogs from the breeding program, it's a question of genetic testing and more judicious breeding of carrier individuals.
Well, you know, we've been talking about dogs and cat communication. I think Jackie from Honolulu is on the line with us. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
So describe the menagerie down there in paradise you've got going.
We have a very unusual situation where we have a beagle, who loves our rabbit, is very protective of our bunny. They play together in the yard. They sleep together in the sun. And one of the things that happens is the bunny has a cage that it sleeps in at night. We have feral cats around in Hawaii. And if there happens to be something disturbing at night, the bunny will pound on the cage, and the dog will shoot out of the house and go barking and protect the yard and then go look in on the bunny and make sure the bunny's okay. It's just amazing to see. And I never really thought much of it. We were having a dinner party, and we had people, and the bunny pounded the cage, and my girlfriend turned to me and said, "What on earth is that?" And I said, "Oh, she's calling the dog." And the dog shot out barking a few minutes later, and she said, "That's the most amazing thing I've ever seen." And I thought, well, maybe that is kind of unusual. It just happens here every day, so it didn't seem unusual to me.
Thanks for the call, Jackie.
Thank you.
And Professor Corin, is that even more unusual? Since aren't beagles supposed to be exactly those kinds of dogs you talked about that hunt hares?
Well, the bonding of dogs to other animals is well known. And dogs can bond not just to human beings, but they can bond to cats, to monkeys, to rabbits, obviously, as in this particular case. It has to do with their early experience. And not only do they bond, but very often they'll model behavior. I mean, I got an email from some people in Philadelphia, and they had a little terrier by the name of Flash, and it was a rescue dog, and it was very, very young. It was about 5 weeks of age or that sort of thing when it was abandoned. And anyway, they brought the dog home, and they had a cat by the name of Mildred who had just had a litter of kittens.
We got to quickly summarize the story. What's the upshot?
Okay. The upshot is that basically Flash learned cat behaviors, including things like, you know, washing his paws and then using them to wash his face with it. That's the kind of bonding.
I'm sorry I stepped on the story, but we are out of time for this hour. I want to thank you, Stanley Coren, author of The Modern Dog, A Joyful Exploration of How We Live with Dogs Today, and Matthew Breen, professor of genomics at the College of Veterinary Medicine at North Carolina State University in Raleigh and member of the Center for Comparative Medicine and Translation Research. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For NPR News in New York, I'm Mike Pesca.